Very good. Okay. So let us continue on this sutta of the for the soil remover about the purification of soul, and also which is the similarly used for how you purify your mind. Very useful similarly, and very good to ponder on this, because this is what heart really is all about. So first of all, we have looked at the most serious, the most coarse of the defilements. These are the gross defilements of body, speech, and mind, and they are roughly equivalent to things like the five precepts, the bad types of speech, and the very coarse kind of mental misconduct. And only when you have removed those, only when those have been dealt with, then should you really move on to the middle defilement. This is how, just reading it out again, that when these have been removed, the coarse ones, they remain in the person, middling defilements, sensual thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of harming. An earnest, capable person abandons his spell, terminates, and considerate. So these are, this is a standard kind of defilements you see in the sutta, the three types of bad thoughts. Sensual thoughts is any thought that has to do with sensual craving, and so craving in the area of the five senses. That, as I mentioned before, I don't think that's the most important one. The most important one is the second one, the thoughts of ill will, and perhaps the third one, the thoughts of harm again. Thoughts of ill will, I think we know pretty much what that is, right? Anger, negativity, upset, hatred, all this kind of stuff, thoughts of ill will. But the last one is quite interesting. The last one is the thoughts of harming. And the term for harming in the sutra is either hinsa or vihinsa. And it's one of those very important terms that we find in Indian philosophy. For example, Mahatma Gandhi, the famous Indian who led the uprising against the British rule in India, he led the Ahimsa movement, right? Ahimsa, which was against protesting in a peaceful way against the British rule of India. And so this is the same kind of term we're seeing here now. So what does it actually mean, thoughts of harming? What does it actually mean? The meaning, it seems to me, is that harming is here the opposite of compassion. Now in English language, the opposite of compassion is really being ruthless or uncaring. You don't care about the consequences that things have for the people around you, so you are ruthless, right? Like a ruthless business person is a person who, for whom profit and business success is much more important than how it affects people around you. So if you don't care about how it affects people around you, because kind of, people are kind of expendable, right? People don't matter. What matters is the success of the business. You are ruthless in that sense. You don't actually have ill will against the people. You don't really necessarily want to harm them, but you don't care about the consequences of what you are doing. So this is what this is about. In English, they have a word, ancient word, goes back to the 17th century, which is ruthful. And ruthful is the same as compassionate. You have ruthless on the one hand, and you have ruthful on the other hand. But it's not a word that you hear anymore. It hasn't been used since the 1750s or something like that. So Ruth in English means compassion. I don't know, you've probably heard the name Ruth, right? Some people are called Ruth, and that actually means compassionate one. Compassion, nice, yeah, compassion, like Karuna. So these are the kind of thoughts. So, you shouldn't, the idea here is that instead of being cold toward people, toward being callous, being uncaring, you have a sense of warmth, understanding of the pain that other beings go through, and for that you care, and you help them, and you have compassion rather than being cold-hearted. A large part of this is about. So these are the middling defilements, and we will talk a lot more later on about how to overcome ill will, is a very important part of the practice. So we'll speak down on that coming up later on. And I'll also talk more about sensuality as well. Because sensuality is basically the whole realm of sensual thoughts, all the attachments we have to our belongings, for example. Whatever belongings you have, your house or whatever, all of that belongs to the realm of sensual thought. So it's a very broad category. Pretty much all the things that we attach to in life is included in that. So if you are earnest and capable, you abandon that, you dispel it, you terminate it and obliterate it using wisdom power, right? Not willpower. And this was one of the last things I was trying to say before we had to break for lunch, is this idea that wisdom power is far more powerful than willpower. Because once you see something clearly, it just disappears just like that. Clear seeing that this anger is dangerous coming in the wrong way, and the anger just goes like that. This is the power of wisdom. So really the only way to obliterate something is to use wisdom. You cannot obliterate things by using willpower. All you can do is really suppress it and oppress it for a while. Okay, then we come to the subtle defilements. This has been done, they remain in that person. Subtle defilements, thoughts about their relations, thoughts about their country, thoughts about their reputation. An earnest, capable person abandons, dispels, and terminates and obliterates them. So at this point, only very refined defilements are remaining. All the main aspects of the defilements have already been removed, right? We have dealt with sensual thoughts and thoughts of ill will. So these are really the kind of main defilements in the mind there. And what remains now is some very subtle things that are left. And these things are still, you know, concerned with attachments in a certain way, but not with but it's kind of, it's getting very refined as we get to this direction. Now if you look at these things, thoughts about your relations, thoughts about your country, and thoughts about your reputation, well, it has a lot to do with our sense of identity, right? Who we think we are. You know, we belong to a certain family, and we have a certain position in the family. You know, you're a daughter or a son, you're a mother or a father, you're a grandparent, and you're a wife or a husband, a sister or a brother, all of these things. You have a certain identity. And not only identity in that sense, but we identify with the kind of family we have, right? What kind of family do you come from? Are you wealthy or poor? Are you, is it high status or low status? And all of these things are things that are very, very close to us, and we identify with very strongly. So this is, for that reason, there are quite strong attachments in these areas. And that's, of course, why it's difficult sometimes to give up one's family completely because of those attachments. Thoughts about one's country, right? You identify with your country, you identify, you belong to a certain group of people, a certain whatever it is, and we identify with that. Right, I'm from Malaysia, or I belong to the Chinese culture, or I belong to Malay culture, I'm from Norway, or whatever it is. All of these things are identities, they're part of our sense of self, of who we are, who we belong to. In Norway, everybody goes skiing, so we attach to the idea of skiing, right? They say in Norway that you are born with skis on your feet, with everybody's skis. Imagine the suffering of being a mother, right? If you're born with skis on your feet, where is all the dukkha? That's one of the disadvantages of being Norwegian. So all of these things are things we identify with, we are, this is our sense of self. This is why this gets very complicated now, because it comes to our sense of self. Right? Sometimes the idea of atta and anatta in Buddhism is a very subtle and refined doctrine. But this is where we can understand it. Because this is where kind of we hold on to this idea. And this is how it comes out in its normal ways, how we can feel the sense of self inside of us. So all of these things we attach to. Reputation, right? Very important thing. And do they like me? Do they not like me? Do I have a bad reputation, a good reputation? And these are kind of things that we are always worried about. And if somebody blames us for the wrong reason, we get upset. And if they praise us for the wrong reason, well, it's okay, then it's not so bad. But they blame us, ooh, that is bad news. So all of these things have to do with a sense of self. So why does this matter? Why is it important? And One reason why it matters is that the sense of self inside of us always needs to be defended, right? If you look at your thinking patterns, almost everybody's way of thinking, it's often about ourselves a lot. You know, if you have been in an argument, you think about, oh, you defend yourself in your head, right? Because you've been in an argument, and you kind of put out your case, and the other person is wrong, and I'm right, this kind of stuff. But a lot of our thinking is about ourselves, about defending who we are, our honor, our dignity, our sense of being right or religion. So because of that, the sense of self can be an obstacle in meditation practice, because it tends to feed the thinking mind, right, about past, about future, about this kind of things. So by reducing your sense of self, reducing who you are, you actually think less, right? You don't worry so much about things. This is part and parcel of what this is. The less attachments we have, attachment to country or family, well, you're going to think about that family if you're attached to it. That's just the way it is. You're going to think about it. I'm Norwegian, I'm living in Australia, wait a minute. You know, you think about these things, and this is what makes it so hard. So by reducing your attachments and reducing that, you're reducing your sense of self, you actually get more peaceful as a consequence. You let attachments go. When attachments go, you can move inside, you can move to samadhi, rather than being preoccupied with the external world of all these things that don't really matter. And it's very beautiful, right? When you start to reduce your attachment to nationality or to even to gender or to a particular position in the family, you can actually embrace other people so much more easily. We're all the same. We're all in the same boat. We all have the same problems. We all have the same aspirations. Nobody wants to suffer. Everybody wants to be happy. The human heart is basically the same. There's no need to define ourselves so much into all these different areas. When you do that, it's so much easier to kind of accept other people. And they may be different, may not have exactly the same understanding, but you can accept them into your life, and you can kind of embrace humanity in a very different way. You know, this is one of the, I think, great things about being a Buddhist. You don't have to be anti-Islamic. We don't have to be anti-Muslims, right? There are lots of nice Muslims out there. Okay, Islam has, you know, there are certain bad things obviously happening, but this doesn't mean that we judge individual people according to their background and culture. We accept individuals. We look at them, and if they are, you know, if they're going the wrong way, it's because of the conditioning on them. And then we have a sense of sympathy. If they're nice, we can understand them and embrace them as human beings. So actually it's quite nice to take away all this identification, all this stuff. It makes us less likely to divide and kind of, you know, make the world up into countries and genders and ages and intelligence degrees and education, all this kind of stuff. But we can accept people as people regardless of who they are. Even animals, right? We accept animals as well. This is one of the beautiful consequences of this. And the more deeper you go into samadhi, the less all of these things matter. Right, it's saying that when you go into a real state of samadhi, when you go into a jhana state, even gender disappears completely. At that point, there's no gender anymore. This is what the Brahma beings are like. When you go into jhana state, they are genderless beings. So it stops at that particular point. And of course, these are very pure beings, right? So the higher you are, the more developed you are, the less differences there is. The more you can kind of come at an equal playing field. All very good, and then you allowing yourself by doing this, allowing your meditation to become more profound, because you have less of these things that you have to defend, think about, being attached to, etc., etc. So then the Buddha said that when this has been done, then there remains only thoughts connected with the Dhamma. Now, this is a translation where I maybe disagree just a little bit with the Kibodhi. I think the correct translation here should be that there remain only thoughts that accord with the Dhamma, that are in accordance with the Dhamma. In other words, the point here is that a thought which accords with the Dhamma is a thought which is undefiled, right? There's no defilement in the thought. They are pure thoughts. Thoughts of loving kindness, thoughts of compassion, thoughts of wisdom, is that what this really is about? So because you are purifying the mind here. So, and I think that makes a little bit of a difference. Thoughts connected with the Dhamma is more like thinking about dependent arising, right, or something like that. But falls that accord with the Dhamma is that thinking the mind which is in the right state, the mind which is undefiled. I did argue with Vicky Boyd about this because I like to argue sometimes. But I didn't get anywhere, but he decided to keep this, which is fair enough. You know, he's in the translator, so I can't really complain. Okay. So only these very last thoughts, and these are very easy to get rid of, right? If you only have this loving kindness, that's all you're thinking, it's very easy to overcome. But because there are these thoughts there, that it says that stillness is not peaceful and sublime, not gained to full tranquility, not attained to unification, but is reined in and checked by forcefully suppressing the defilements. Now that really is a bad translation, right? And I'm sorry to say, Mr. Venerable Vicky Boyd, I have to say, I just pray straight away that Venerable Vicky Boyd, I consider him a great, great translator. He's one of the best ones around, and I have considered him my teacher for so many years in my monastic life. But there comes a point when the student has to take his own stand, right? That's life, right? That's your own stand. And sometimes you have to disagree with your teacher. I think that's perfectly okay. So I did also argue with him on this one, but he didn't really budge on that one either, so what can you say? But anyway, so it's not yet fully concentrated, because even though you have all these beautiful thoughts in your mind, right, loving kindness, compassion, all of that, because the mind is still thinking, there is still movement in the mind. That movement is the opposite of what is here, the full tranquilization. Not gain, he says, by full tranquilization, or not gain to full tranquilization, but either one would be acceptable. So fully tranquil means completely unmoving. Yeah. So hasn't yet gone there, it's not peaceful and sublime, hasn't yet reached the height of samadhi, not attained to unification, right? This is one of the standard ways of describing a mind in samadhi, especially in the jhanas, it is unified. It is not scattered. It is all is kind of coming together in one point, right? One pointedness. The mind is unified. So not yet, hasn't yet come to that point. But it's reined in and checked by forcefully suppressing the defilements. Now the word which Venerable Bodhi has translated as forcefully here is actually sankhara, or sa-sankhara. And sankhara in the sutras, the main meaning of sankhara in the sutras is actually the will. It's the doing aspect of the mind together. It's simply with chetana, with the word we had a really quick look at the very first sutra, translated as volition there. It's the same word, or the same, they are defined in terms of each other. So it doesn't, I'm not sure why he translated as forcefully here. What it really means is that the will is still active. The doing aspect of the mind is still active, right? So you ask, it means that because the mind is moving, there's still some doing going on. And if you see that the defilement is about to arise, you turn the mind in a different direction to make sure the defilement doesn't arise. And so it is an activity of the mind that keeps the defilement in check. That is how I would translate this answer. So the mind is still actively keeping the defilements in check. And that is what I think is a better way of looking at this. Because at this point, the mind is becoming very peaceful, right? Becoming very, very close to a full samadhi. There's no defilements left in the mind. The idea of using force at this point is really, to me, kind of outside of what really, really works at this particular point. But the active control, the active restraint of the defilements is, I think, a good way of looking at this. The mind is still a little bit active, a little bit going on in there, but already it's getting very beautiful. At this point, we're already perhaps starting to see things like nimittas, right? Lots of happiness, enjoying the mind, everything is very peaceful. If you remember the previous sutta we looked at, so it's already getting very, very nice at this stage. But then comes the even nicer part, I can put it next. Bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, and all laymen and laywomen, there comes a time when his mind becomes internally steady, composed, unified, and still. That stillness is the peaceful and sublime gain, the supreme tranquility, and attains unification. It is not actively checked, the departments are not actively checked and reined in. Then the being is suitable basis and is capable of realizing any state realizable by direct knowledge towards which he might incline his mind. Okay, I'm going to explain that piece in a second because it may not be very obvious then. So here we can have this idea that comes the time, right? You don't know how long it's going to take. Yeah? You're not aiming for any particular goal, you're not aiming for any particular state, but you know that if you practice in the right way, the results will eventually have to come. Because that is what happens when you practice in the right way. So all you're doing is you're sitting back, you're watching the breath, doing your metta, doing your meditation objective. And as that meditation object develops, the defilements are gradually disappearing into the background. But one of the things that is said about breath meditation, for example, is that it cuts off thought. And because there is still a little bit of thought left in the background here, the breath meditation is a great object to use to bring that unification of the mind. You're watching the breath, and eventually the mind matures in such a way that comes that time when the mind is internally steady, santitita is a Pali word, standing together, sannisidati, which means like sitting down together, right? It's kind of calming down, sitting down, and becoming unified. Then unified is the next one. Ekodibhuta, ekodibhava, or ekodibhoti, I think it is here actually. It means becoming one, becoming unified. And the last one is samadhati, which is stilled. Right? All of these things are words that are used in the suttas to describe a mind that is entering into the jhana state. This is all about the jhana states you've seen here now. So this is where we're coming. There comes a time when finally the mind is so peaceful, so delightful, that you enter into this uttari manusadama, this state beyond the human realm, beyond humanity. This is literally what it means. This is what the jhana is all about. And that samadhi, that stillness, is peaceful and sublime. It is gained to full tranquilization, to full tranquility, right? No movement anymore. Attained to unity, unification. The mind is completely together. There's no movement from one moment to the next one. And there is no use of the will here to suppress and rein in and check the hindrances or the defilements. And this is like an important one, this very interesting one, last one. There's no use of the will, right? In other words, the point here is that when you enter, this is one of the few places where you find this idea, that when you enter a state of samadhi, of deep samadhi, especially the jhanas, there is no will anymore, there's no movement of the mind. You're not doing anything yet. The will is completely gone. And this is one of those things that makes this state so unusual and so different from anything else you have ever experienced before. We always use our will, right? We always say, I'm going to do this. You kind of control the mind a little bit. Everything we do has to do with willpower in one way or another. And this is the first time in your life where the will, all the doing inside, is completely gone. Right? This is kind of very, this is why these days are so mystical and so different, because you experience something that you have never ever experienced in your entire life before. The will, the doing, you can't even do. Even if you want to do, you can't, because the mind is unified, right? If you could do something and move your mind, it wouldn't be unified anymore. The very fact that it's unified means that there is no movement possible while you are in that state. You're just standing there, waiting, no will, right? And it's peaceful. I mean, it sounds very scary, right? But I can't do anything. Gee, that's really scary. What if I don't want to be there? What if I don't like it, right? Oh, really, really scary. But this is one of the things, while I was saying in the meditation this morning, notice that when you feel peaceful, when you are kind of present in the present moment, right? You're just aware, you're just staying with the present moment. Notice how nice that is. You're not doing so much anymore. You're just passively aware of what is happening. And when you are aware, when you see and how nice it is just to be passive, and you're starting to understand why the will is a problem, and why actually getting rid of the will is so nice. That makes you less afraid, right? When you see that this actually is a boon, is a benefit, it's wonderful when the will is disappearing, then you kind of, okay, and let's go for the full hog, let's go for it, let's get those dharmas, right? And you become inspired by that. And this is so important because the teaching of the Buddha can sometimes be frightening to people. Let go of the will, gee, I'm not ready for that. No self, right? Ooh, what about me? I want to be here. But this is the other thing I would like you also to look at. No self-teaching can seem very scary. Why? Because it's about me, right? I want to be happy. This is no self, you know. How does that work out? It sounds really scary. How do you let go of the self? What does that mean? But it's actually very simple. And it's very, very easy to understand why it is good. All you have to do is watch in your meditation practice. When you become more peaceful, when there's less thinking going inside of you, there's less concern about yourself, right? Thinking about yourself. The less there is of all that stuff, the better you feel. Right? So the less self there is, remember the self, it manifests through your thinking about yourself, who you are, your relationships, all of these things. The less thinking there is, the less self there is. And wow, it is so beautiful. It's a wonderful thing, right? And of course, then when you understand that it is a wonderful thing, it gives you confidence that actually, if I go to completely to no self, probably great, right? Probably a wonderful thing. Because a little bit is good, and going all the way probably is nice as well. So it is all about how it is so important to understand this teaching, to perceive them in the right way, think about them in the right way, and think, gee, I don't want to be Buddhist anymore, this is just too scary, right? Think about them in the right way, and wow, actually, it's very inspiring, it's a very beautiful way, and you want to continue in the right way. This is so, so important because Buddhism is very profound, and if you kind of start off with the wrong teachings, it can put you off for life. And that's why you have to be very careful with these things. It's important to understand these things in the right way. So that is no will, right? This is what it says. No will when you get into this deep, profound jhana state. All completely gone. This is one of the places where it says that. Then, there being a suitable basis, he is capable, or that person is capable of realizing any state realizable by direct knowledge towards which they might incline their mind. So, this is quite interesting, it is for me anyway. I was inventing how this would be translated. I was inventing with my friend Adnan Sujato, who is now translating all the sutras, the whole four Nikayas, is staying in Taiwan somewhere, just doing translation work and a little bit online, but not much. And what this meaning is of there being a suitable basis. What does that mean? And the standard understanding of this means that it is when you have cultivated the path in the right way and you have the right kind of paramis and you have the right personality or whatever, when all of those things come together, that means there is a suitable basis. And then, if the basis is suitable, then you can, you know, attain all the insights and all the psychic powers, all that kind of stuff. But that is what it means by any state realizable by direct knowledge. That means all of these amazing things, you know, the insights and the psychic powers or whatever, you can realize. That's what that means. But it is a bit strange that it says there being a suitable basis, because this whole sutta is about creating that suitable basis, right? So why does it say now there being a suitable basis? And I think that I think that meaning probably is that it's not so much about what you have done or the kind of qualifications you have, but rather wherever there is something to be realized. That's actually what it means. Wherever there is anything to be realized, then you are capable to realize that. So there is a limited amount of things in the world that can be realized. But those things that can be realized, you are able now to realize them. So whatever there is a foundation, whatever there is something, anything which the mind can understand, you have the potential to understand that at this point. Anyway, I'll leave that. If you don't understand what I mean, then that's fine. But it doesn't really matter so much. The point is, now your mind is ready, right? Your mind is unified. You you have got the profound samadhi, just go for it, enjoy yourself. But most importantly of all is to realize, of course, the profound insights. But if you are inclined, so you can, according to the sutras, you can do all kind of weird stuff at this point, like walking on water and sinking into the earth and walking through mountains. That would be cool. When you walk through mountains, you can just walk into the mountains. Just disappearing into the rock, right? That would be really, just sinking into the earth. Tell us some kind of science fiction movie. But this is what the sutras say, basically, that it's possible at this point. One of the things, of course, that the Buddha said, which is also very interesting, and this is from the Kavata Sutta in the Digha Nikaya, he says there, which is fascinating, that he doesn't like these psychic powers. He abhors them. He talks about them in actually very strong negative terms. This is in the Digha Nikaya 11, Kavata Sutta. And then this person asks him, why is that the case? Why do you think that you are so negative about these psychic powers then? And the Buddha says, well, if somebody, performs any of these psychic powers, like flying through the air, reading minds or whatever, the person who is a believer, they will be fine, they have no problem with them, they will say, okay, yeah, wow, that's really cool, isn't it? That'd be great. But the person who is skeptical will say, oh, it's only a magic trick, right? It's only they're using some kind of strategy and creating a magic trick. But this is not the right way of actually convincing people about the Buddhist teachings. Because these are, anyway, they're not really the essence of what Buddhism is all about. And people who don't believe will not be impressed by that kind of thing. And there was I don't know if anyone here saw it, but there was a few years ago, there was an English magician, and his name was Dynamo. And he one day was standing, the River Thames in London, right? He was standing on the shore, or he was standing on maybe a little jetty or something, and jutting out into the River Thames. And then there was the Waterloo Bridge, I think, there's a big bridge going up the river just next to it. And all these people were standing up there watching this man, right? And then he would put one, there's a very low jetty, very close to the surface of the water. And then he would start walking off the jetty, down onto the water, right? And then he would walk onto the surface of the water, and he would walk out on the water. And people would look at people would look at this fellow, right? Wow, he's actually walking on water. Maybe it's Jesus Christ coming back or something. It's the second coming, right? What's going on here? And of course, he was a magician, so of course he wasn't walking on the water, it's only an illusion. But people were really staring at him. You can see that people are absolutely shocked when they see this man walking out on the water. And later on, of course, he divulged how he did that. How is it that you walk on water? It's very easy. All you have to do is you put some kind of transparent glass or something which floats on the water. It's actually a piece of plastic or whatever, very strong. And it goes out into the water and you walk on that. No problem, you can walk on the water, right? And this is what magic is all about. And this was kind of a classic example of how you can do things which normally kind of baffles people. So for that reason, I don't really recommend too much concern about this psychic power. There tends to be too much concern about that in the Buddhist world. It's not something that I would encourage people to believe too much in. Very often you hear stories about these things, and in my experience, those stories are very, very unreliable. People tend to see what they want to see, hear what they want to hear, right? So it is very, very unreliable. When you see it for yourself, okay, then maybe you can believe. But still, be careful, right? It might be Dynamo walking out on the river tent. So even then, be careful. Okay, anyway, so here we are. So that is what happens, right? So it's actually wonderful. You get this extraordinarily powerful mind, and you can do whatever you like with it. And that is basically what this is about. And of course, the main thing is to gain those insights, the vijna, the recollection of the past lives, and the destruction of all defilements is what really comes at this stage. Okay, so that is the gradual removal of the defilements. The things towards the end here are very profound, but I think everybody can understand what is the, can use this kind of teaching, because it gives you an idea of where you're at and how you have to proceed on the Buddhist path.